Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sarah Dunant, whose book is The Birth of Venus, about Florence, about Savonarola, historical novel by someone who writes mysteries, has written three mysteries, BBC commentator. Sarah Dunant, in the literature that came with the book, we learn about how you came to write this. You were in Florence, you broke up with your boyfriend, and walked into an apartment. Everything was dark. It felt as if you were back in the 15th century. Is that right?
Very nearly. There's a little bit in the middle between the breakup and the apartment. I was very much in love with someone. In fact, this person came from Marin County, so I have no idea if they're back there and maybe even listening to this. And we spend Christmas and New Year in Florence, and we had one of those meals off one of the piazzas in Florence where you kind of know the thing is ending, to such an extent that one of us left the restaurant before the other. And as I walked out into the city and thought, okay, so that's my future gone. What am I going to do next? And I was also facing one of those birthdays with a noughts in it. I thought, actually, I need to do something dramatic to make my life in the future as interesting as it's been in the past. And it was then that I thought, I really like this city. I don't know it very well. I only know it as a tourist. I'm going to make an effort to get to know it better. And so later that year, I bought, or actually the bank bought, but you know what? I'm going to pay them back. The bank bought a small apartment just off that same piazza. And it was the very first time when I came to actually pick up the keys to the apartment and sign the papers. And I was due to fly back to London that night, and my flight was cancelled. All I had in my handbag was the keys to this apartment, which had no electricity, no running water, no gas, no nothing. And the only thing in the apartment was three duvets and three pillows, which I'd bought as kind of proof that me and my two daughters were at some point going to live there. So I went upstairs and I lay down in the darkness on these three duvets and three pillows. And it was very hot and I opened the windows. So first of all the mosquitoes came in and bit me. And second, from across the road, a light went on, very sort of glowing light, which could have been candlelight. And thirdly, at about 1 o'clock in the morning, all these drunken young Italian men walked down the street below and their voices kind of bounced off the cobbles up to me. And as I lay there, I thought, my God, this is probably what it was like in the 15th century, eaten alive by mosquitoes, no running water, no electricity, and all these drunken young louts below screaming up here. And I think that was what gave me the gem of a novel. And then later I came back and started to study the period and work at it.
At the time, were you working on another mystery or anything like that?
No. In fact, at the time, I was a little worried that I was not going to write again. I had been writing, for want of a better word, literary thrillers. And I really knew why I wanted to write thrillers. I wanted to write thrillers because they were popular. And in my journalism, I spent a lot of time trying to say serious things about the world in a popular form. But I had got slightly frustrated by the form of thrillers, because thrillers do need a certain formula. They do have a certain set of rules. And they make you read very fast, but sometimes they don't allow you to luxuriate in what you're reading, because you're pushed on by the adrenaline too much. And by the time I wrote the last thriller before this, Mapping the Edge, which is set in contemporary Florence, I knew that I'd pushed the form about as far as I could push it. So I was looking to do something else, but was very lost as to what it would be. And so in a funny way, Florence found me and helped me out of quite a sort of dark writer's block.
At the same time, you do have the pacing of a thriller, which you normally don't get in a historical novel. Because, I mean, that I guess, was internalized at some point.
Yeah. You know, the reason that there were great artists in Florence at this time, there's a million reasons, but one of them was because they spent a lot of time being an apprentice to a master. They learnt a trade before they ever got their hands on the wall. And I kind of feel like that. I feel like I've learnt a trade as a mystery thriller writer. And my trade is to tell a compulsive story. So I don't think I'll ever lose it. Now, if with luck I can use that to then really write stuff which is interesting and different and serious, but make sure that once you pick up the book you want to carry on reading it, then not only, hopefully, will I write successful books, but I'll also write books about something serious which people will want to read.
We'll get into some of the specifics, because one of the aspects of Birth of Venus that hit me, resonated with me, is the relationship with contemporary politics. And I think that that's maybe, if the book is hitting the bestseller list, I think that's what's going on, because there are some amazing ones. But first, let's talk a little bit more about some of the ideas in the book. Your main character is 15 years old, and she's a painter. And this is kind of interesting because there have recently been books about women painters of the, well, we have a little bit later, Artemisia's, the book about Artemisia by Susan Vreeland. Mm-hmm. We have Tracy Chevalier's book about Vermeer.
Yeah.
There are several other books about women and painters.
Mm.
How familiar were you with that entire genre?
Oh, not at all.
Really?
Actually, it was a real shock. I was doing the second rewrite on The Birth of Venus, and I came out to Vancouver to visit some friends, and one of them was reading Girl with a Pearl Earring, and I said, what's that about? And they said, oh, it's about a young woman living in the house of Vermeer. And I thought, oh, my God, no. Where have I been? And the answer is that I'd sort of been in Florence, both in my head and literally. But actually, I think what's different about this book is that it's actually not about a woman painter, it's about a woman who longs to paint, but who cannot because of the time that she's living in. You know, this is not called Botticelli's Sister. It's not a sort of Shakespeare's Sister book. It doesn't say, hey guys, there was a fantastically brilliant, as yet undiscovered artist in Renaissance Florence, and she was a woman, and I'm going to tell you about her. Because actually, there couldn't have been fantastic women artists because of a whole set of social and political circumstances which would have stopped them. But what happened to me is after I'd spent my beginning of that first summer in Florence reading all about this incredible moment in the 15th century when the Renaissance hits darkened Western Christianity and it brings in kind of Platonic thought and it brings in this new revolutionary art of three dimensions and it changes the way we think and it changes the way we see the world. Then my young daughters came out to visit me and at the time they were 10 and 13 and I took them out into the streets convinced that I'd send them home the most educated little kids in the world. And the first thing my 13-year-old said to me was, I'm sorry, Mom, I think you should know that it's a moment in my life I don't do culture, I just do shopping. And then my 10-year-old said, because she wanted to be different from the 13-year-old, well, I'll look at some art, Mom, that's fine, show me. And it was as I was walking through the streets with those, one defiant and attitude on the stick, the other kind of really into it, that I thought, oh, my God, the one thing missing from all the research that I've done is women. All the painters, all the philosophers, all the thinkers, all the politicians, all the artists are all men. What was it like to be living in this city if you were a woman? And so my character, as you've said, is a young 15-year-old girl, daughter of a wealthy cloth merchant, very well educated because these young women were in this new learning. And I then gave her this one attribute, that she had a talent to draw, but of course she didn't yet know if she could paint because nobody would let her get her hands on the wall. And that's how it started.
The book is set at a very specific time. So let's set the stage a little bit, because how many years had the de' Medicis been in power in Florence at that point? About how long when the book begins?
Okay. Cosimo de' Medici, who's the first of the Medicis that makes a political statement, really, and what he kind of does is to convert this republic into an enlightened dictatorship by controlling who gets voted in and out. Very wealthy, a banker, the Pope's banker, starts to take control around the 1430s, 1440s. And then his son Piero and then his grandson Lorenzo de' Medici, Lorenzo the Magnificent, lives until 1492. And it's during that period that the Medicis have a stable Florence, albeit no longer actually a republic, but a very stable, wealthy Florence built on cloth and this beautiful cloth. And they are the patrons of the city and the patrons of the art.
Sarah Dunant, what relationship, if any, did Venice have? Because Venice is not mentioned in your book. Were they just so totally separate?
Yes, the amazing thing about Italy at this moment is it's not a country, of course. It's a selection of city-states. And Venice, which is not so much a republic, it's an oligarchy because it's based on a very small ruling class.
Right.
And is very stable and I think is somewhat more conservative than Florence is. And they make treaties with each other, and they view each other with a certain level of suspicion. But Florence is the cauldron of the Renaissance, and it's the cauldron of the new art. Venice takes over in the next century. But Florence is the city. It's where it's happening. And the Medici are amazing figures, actually. Later on in the family history, the Medici's become quite corrupt. But in these early guys, they are a mixture of diplomats, politicians, very acute power manipulators, but also scholars. also very intelligent men, also very tasteful patron of the arts. They have the greatest sculpture galleries around. You know, this is a time when if you're building your house in Rome or in Crete, you'll put your shovel through the earth and you'll find a piece of sculpture that's 2,000 years old. Well, a bit like the Paul Getty Museum, they buy it and they bring it to Florence, right? And they have all the big artists on their books. So Donatello, Botticelli, Fra Angelico, Fra Lippo Lippi, all of them are paid by the Medici to glorify this city. So it looks like everything is just hunky-dory in Florence.
That brings in the next question, because you made a specific choice to set this book at the death of Lorenzo de' Medici when Savonarola is coming in. This, I would assume, has to do with obviously setting a turbulent background against the story itself, which makes it more interesting. But there's also connections with what's happening today. The obvious connection from your publicist is Iran, the transition from the Shah to Khomeini. But I think the connection could easily be drawn between the powers of light and darkness, if you want to call it that, enlightenment and the fundamentalists here in the United States.
Yeah, I think you can cut it every which way. I think you can cut it to the Taliban in Afghanistan. I think you can cut it to Iran, and I think you can cut it here. I have to say that when I started writing the book, it was not my intention to use history as a way of lecturing the present. And to a certain extent, I think it's quite dangerous to write your fiction as if you had a political platform. And I've learned that because I began my life as quite a left-wing, deliberately political thriller writer, because I was working in a genre that was so conservative and I wanted to bring other issues into the table. But I've since learned that the best fiction comes from your imagination, and as soon as you trammel it with anything, your imagination isn't wide enough. So I wrote the book at this moment because it was, as you say, a fantastic moment of conflict, both for my heroine and the state. Having said that, it became utterly clear to me as I was writing it that the modern parallels were kind of hitting me in the face. What happens is Lorenzo de' Medici dies, and the problems with what is basically an inherited monarchy now is if your son isn't up to it, the politics start to shake. And they shake at a moment in Florentine history when Florence is also being threatened by the outside and there's a French army coming in towards her. And it's at this moment when Florentines get scared. And here's another parallel here. It's when people get frightened, when the things outside start to frighten you, that the political screws start to turn. At this moment of fear, this monk's voice emerges from the pulpit, and he's demagogic, and he's charismatic, and he's fundamentalist, and he's an aesthetic. He scourges himself every day, and he doesn't like the new learning, and he doesn't like the new art, because he says, you know, look at these guys. Look at Plato and Aristotle. They're pagans. They lived and died before Christ. They're burning in hell now. Why should you listen to them? And he looks at the new art on the wall, and he says, now you see these flesh and blood men and women, and they're so beautiful, and they're standing right next to God, and they're the same size as him. Now we take our eye off God, and we take our eye away from the spiritual into the carnal. And he scares Florence. And as a result of that, when the French come in and he negotiates them and they leave, he actually starts to rule Florence like a theocracy. And this is where the modern parallels just flood in. So under Savonarola, women have their place, and it's in the home. And if they leave the home, they cannot be wearing any sumptuous garments. They have to be veiled in case their beauty should somehow tempt men. They're not allowed to go to church if you're preaching matters of state, because politics is not women's business. He bans gambling. He bans dancing. And he also comes down incredibly heavily on what is a quiet, emerging gay culture in Florence. It's not official. It's always underneath the surface, because we're still in a very Catholic era. But if you study the court records, there has been quite a lot of homosexuality in Florence up until this time. Under Savonarola, it stops dead in its tracks.
The night police. Now, were they Savonarolas, or do they predate?
They predate them. There's a lot of very interesting police forces in Florence at this time. So there are a police force called the Sumptuary Police, and this happened all over Europe, because they were worried about too many people getting too rich and how the poor would feel about it. But the Sumptuary Police were so easy to bribe. You know, you were only supposed to have like 7 courses at your wedding banquet. But if you were really rich and you wanted to have 24 courses, you just invited the Sumptuary Police in and they ate with you, so that, you know, power can always be corrupted. It's just fine. And the Night Police's job was literally to stick their noses in dark alleys in Florence, of which there are a lot when it gets dark, to see what sin is going on. And actually, there's a great demographic in Florence at this moment, because young women get married at 14 or 15, pure as the driven snow, and believe me, if anyone's got in the window and they're not pure, the marriage is immediate. But young men aren't allowed to marry till their early 30s because they're not considered responsible enough to be good citizens. So you've got a lot of testosterone out on the streets there. Now, some of it in the dark alleys goes into prostitution, which is supposed to be not official, but everybody accepts it's there. But some of it goes into an emerging gay culture.
You're listening to an interview with Sarah Dunant, whose book is The Birth of Venus, a novel. The gay culture, just like what it's like to be a woman, we would assume that there's pretty limited information about it, and yet it seems that you describe it pretty carefully. I mean, there are the equivalent of gay bars. There's a street near the Ponte Vecchio, La Bocca, where they go. One of the characters, the husband of, it's pretty obvious from the beginning, though she doesn't know, we know, we suspect from the first moment, is gay, or whatever the equivalent would be at that particular time, because there were no words for it. How did you find out about that life? Was it from reading the court records?
What's happened in history over the last 30 years is, my God, America knows more about this than most, because you've had the battle more powerfully, which is, do we follow dead white males and battles and politicians and famous generals, or do we go deeper into the history that's been buried, like women's history, like gay history? Well, a lot of work has been done on the underbelly of history here. I couldn't have written this book 30 years ago. It wouldn't have been possible. But I actually did discover, and I give a bibliography at the back, because I think this is a fascinating period and some of the historians really ought to get their dues. I give bibliographies of historians who've written, looking at court records, or looking, there's an American who's called Michael Rock, who's written a book called Forbidden Friendships, which is a book studying the night police in Florence in the 15th century. And what he comes out with, and what I used and was tremendously helpful to me, was the fact that up until Savonarola, this gay culture was quite accepted, not least because a number of very prominent names of Florentine families were coming before the courts, so the fines were quite lenient. If you were unlucky enough not to have a good name, you might end up in prison. Leonardo is at some point accused, in I think the 1480s, of having a gay relationship or being with a group of young men. He's shoved in prison and his patron gets him out. But what happens when Savonarola comes in is everything changes. He rails against sodomy from the pulpit, and the punishments are much more extreme. So if you're caught under the age of 18, therefore you're seen, it's the equivalent of the kind of rent boy, you're seen as the tempter, you're seen as the woman, actually, in the relationship, you can be mutilated. They'll cut off your nose. This is what they did to prostitutes to ruin their vanity, to ruin their beauty. Over 18, if you're found to be a multiple offender, you risk going to the stake. Now, Florence never actually burns any gay men at the stake. She finds them, and they are tortured, and they go up before the church, and at the very last minute, they're given life imprisonment. Or one particular man, who's notoriously known to be gay in the city, is sent to an asylum for the rest of his life. You mentioned Venice earlier. Venice is much tougher. Venice burns a number of gay men at the stake. Venice has rules which says all barber shops have to close after 6 o'clock, because we think that's where these men may be gathering. And dancing schools, they have to have no back rooms, and they have to close at 6 o'clock too, because after dark you can never be sure what's happening. So for a society that's not supposed to have sodomy, because it's a terrible sin, there's actually a lot of it going on underneath.
Well, I think that that's probably true through every society, certainly. You know, look at Victorian England.
Oh, completely. And, you know, that is the one thing that was so apparent to me doing the research here. You know, we now have a debate between fundamentalist Christian groups about whether or not God did not intend there to be such a thing as homosexuality. Well, any historian will tell you that there is no place in society that you can go in history where there is not evidence of gay cultures. It is absolutely central to the human condition. So the notion that one should have a rule against it is almost a way of sort of making up a sin in order to then have control over it.
Sarah, there are many other areas of Florence that you get into, one of which I knew nothing about, which is slavery. Our heroine, Alessandra, has a black slave named Arilla. black slaves. I mean, we see images of them certainly in paintings.
Yeah.
Where did they come from, and how prevalent was slavery? The other question, just a quick answer. What was the population of Florence around that time?
Oh, I think it's a couple of hundred thousand.
It moves
up and down because of the plague coming in and hitting it occasionally. I knew nothing about slavery either. It was a complete surprise to me. But there's a lot of trading going on in the East,
right.
And there's a lot of piracy going on. So Venice has a very thriving slave market, and Arila comes from North Africa. There are also slaves from somewhere in Russia and Eastern Europe. And as you say, you can see black figures as grooms or as part of the journey of the Magi in many of the big frescoes, the most famous ones. And this is an area where the historians are only just starting to work. It is absolutely clear that in medieval Europe there were black people. And they were not just exotic and strange. They were actually part of the fabric, but nobody's yet done the work on them. And she was a great character for me because she's got more freedom, ironically, even though she's a slave, than my young woman has, who has to stay in the house. So technically she works because she can move around the city and bring things back. And also she's worldly in a way which my young heroine can't be. And a relationship grows up between them, which I think is one of the most powerful relationships in the book between these two women from very different backgrounds, because the slave is bright and she's been educated. She's probably not Christian, but pretends to be in order to fit in with society. She was a great discovery. I love her.
There's also nunneries where the women wind up. All the women, it appears, I mean, if we trust what we see in film and what we read about, at a certain point when a woman becomes a widow, boom, she's off. Weren't these women, some of them, extremely upset that they were being, let's say, imprisoned in this religious life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, basically, if you weren't married and you were over the age of 14, Florentine society was scared of what to do with you. It's fear again, because you're a potentially sexual being on the street, and you could be corrupting men, because, of course, the women did all the corruption. The men weren't apparently responsible at all for it. The convents were one way of getting rid of your daughters. And it also happens that at this time, as Florence gets wealthier, the dowries that fathers pay for their daughters to marry well goes up and up. So they don't have enough money to marry all the daughters off. So if you're unlucky enough to be the second or third daughter, you get shoved into a convent. Now, you're right. Suddenly there's a lot of young women in convents. And, yeah, they believe in God. There's not really any opportunity not to believe in God at this time. But they certainly don't have a vocation to believe in God. So they arrive in the convents with their marriage chests full of really beautiful silks and fabrics and a couple of books which aren't that religious and some works of art. And basically the numbers overwhelm the rules. In certain convents around the late 15th century, what you see is they're out in the country, so nobody looks at them. Nobody comes near them to check them out. And these young women start to wear their own clothes as opposed to the habits, and they really enjoy singing, so they do a lot of singing, and some of them write plays because they're really well educated, and then the other nuns put the plays on, and there's really quite a level of creative freedom. And the reason we know about it is, once again, because sometimes it goes too far and breaks the rules, so they end up in court. So you start to look at the court records and find it.
So the convent that Alessandra winds up in is a convent virtually from history, then?
Yes. It's a composite of a number of convents. The convent I've actually invented there didn't exist, but convents very like it in Venice existed very nearby. And in the court records, you find things like young women tunneling underneath the wine cellars so as men can get in. One particular convent where the Reverend Mother has two children. And finally, the court finds out about them. So it's only when things go wrong and they get discovered, and since only a small number get discovered, you can be pretty certain that elsewhere there's a certain level of creative transgression going on in these places.
Sarah Dunant, you have a lot of serpent imagery. What is the origin of that? Why did you make the choice to have the serpent be such a major part of the book?
Oh, because the serpent's quite a major part of Christianity at this moment. This is the only place where I'm being really cheeky. as a woman. Okay. There really is my feminism comes through very subtly in this book, I hope, because I want it to speak for itself. It doesn't need to be knocked on the head. You get
right.
it. The prologue has this image of this nun, I don't want to give too much away, with a serpent on her body, and the serpent has a male head. If you look at all the Christian iconography of this period, when you go to the Garden of Eden and you see Eve as arch-villain number one and female being tempted by the snake, yabbering in her ear so she'll actually eat the apple, very often the snake has a woman's face because they see the woman as the temptress. So Eve's talking to this really beautiful woman snake and she's convinced and she eats the apple. When I originally had that idea of the snake on the body, I was thinking of three or four different paintings which I've seen in Florence. And suddenly I thought, I think I'm going to put a male face on this snake. And that's my very quiet feminist dick.
Well, Sarah Dunant, now you've written The Birth of Venus. You're working on a book about Venice. You do have a series of three PI books featuring Hannah Wolff. Do you ever plan to go back to those?
No. No. I don't understand how people write 12 or 13 books about the same character. I mean, when I wrote Hannah Wolff, when I was much younger and sassier, and I wanted to say a lot of things about contemporary society through her, she felt very powerful. And then I had kids, and then my life changed, and she and I weren't the same person anymore. And I think I'm a great believer that it's the way that life throws you curved balls and challenges you that makes you get better at things, and that's no different being a writer. You know, the curved ball in my life at this moment was the relationship ending, having to find a new way forward, and suddenly Florence arrives out of the curved
right,
ball,
yeah.
And so I write this. And now I've discovered that writing historical fiction is very exciting but very difficult if you're going to write it well, because you have to learn a lot to then wear your knowledge lightly enough to convince people that they're in it.
Sarah Dunant, do you miss journalism?
I don't miss journalism with this novel because I'm learning so much. I only gave up journalism about 6 months ago when I realized how much time it was going to take me to research the next novel. And up until then, journalism had been my way of keeping myself kind of intellectually on the ball.
When, where was that?
In the BBC. Doing a program, in some ways, which I think is a bit like your station. I was doing a program where culture and politics came together, and you could discuss quite difficult subjects in a way that current affairs wouldn't let you, because it had to always be about facts,
right, yeah.
rather than ideas. That's why I think culture is so revolutionary, and we ought to take a lot of notice of it. And I loved doing that. So week after week, we'd do a different subject that came up from the news, and I'd have to learn a lot in that week to be able to chair the discussion. And it was very exciting. When I started to write The Birth of Venus, it meant that I was being pulled out of 15th century Florence every week into something contemporary. And they started to work against each other rather than working for each other. And I've now made the decision to give it up. Ask me again in a year when I've been in, you know, the record libraries in Venice and nobody's spoken to me and I'm feeling completely lost, and I might give you a different story.
You've been listening to an interview with Sarah Dunant, whose book is The Birth of Venus, a novel. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.